You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, after Qatar, Norway and Abu Dhabi, now Angola launches a sovereign wealth fund. We'll ask if any returns will ever reach the inhabitants of one of the world's poorest countries. Also ahead, we'll explore who's on and who's off the list of the world's most important figures in the art world.
One of the more exotic inclusions, which is Pussy Riot, so I guess you could argue whether or not they're artists, aren't at the top, because it would be much more sensational to put them right up there. And I think it's very much trying to reflect on the actual forces that are actually shaping the kind of art that's being produced.
And we'll meet the winner of this year's prestigious Wildlife Photographer of the Year award, a man who went to extraordinary lengths to gain the trust of his subjects.
They relax so well that the shot that I like, the one that won, is a large emperor penguin is resting against my head and his body is framed in my fisheye lens. And as he's resting there, I think the other penguins took relaxation. They got relaxed seeing him there resting against me.
We'll be hearing more from Paul Nicklin later on in the programme. And we'll also be talking to Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, about some of her highlights from a year of Monocle 24. All that, plus we'll play you some music too. That's all to come here in the next hour on Midori House. But before that, let's get the latest world headlines from Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Differences are emerging between European leaders in Brussels on the eve of their two-day summit, the 22nd since the EU first began to face up to its debt crisis. Speaking before a meeting of the European Socialist Party, French President François Hollande said the summit's top priority should be to establish a banking union before the end of 2012. Earlier, German Chancellor Angela Merkel called for the European Commission to be given greater authority to veto national budgets that breach EU rules. But Monsieur Hollande said such discussions are not on the agenda. Lithuania's President Dalia Grybauskaitė says they've got a lot to talk about.
I think there are a lot of questions and uncertainties in the concept. We need general supervision, but how to do it, I think we still will be discussing very much, because a lot of details are unclear, including that some of ideas contradict to our treaties.
Much of Greece is being closed down by a 24-hour general strike. Public and private sector workers have joined the walkout, shutting down transport, offices, shops and schools. It's the second such strike in 3 weeks, called in protest at a new wave of wage and pension cuts demanded by foreign leaders. Greece is preparing €11.5 billion of cuts to appease the European Union and International Monetary Fund and secure the next instalment of its €130 billion bailout. The Colombian government and left-wing FARC rebels have arranged their first direct talks for a decade. After almost 50 years of conflict, the two sides launched the peace process at a hotel in Norway, with negotiations expected to last several months. Colombian officials say both sides have agreed on the need for social change. Human rights groups in Syria say nearly 30,000 people are missing after being abducted by the army or pro-government militia. The online activist group Avaaz says the government is conducting a campaign of terror from which nobody is safe. The Turkish foreign minister says Iran has indicated its support for a temporary ceasefire in Syria, as proposed by UN Arab League envoy Lakhdar Brahimi. Meanwhile, the United Nations has presented a $348 million assistance plan to increase aid to Syrian refugees. UNHCR regional coordinator Panos Mountsis says they're needed to get ready for winter.
We have systematically seen over the last few months a daily increase of 2,000 to 3,000. At the moment it stands at 2,000 per day. Actually, the crossing of the border takes place day and night. Many people cross also at night. So we want to make sure as humanitarian actors, and this is a collective work of 52 organizations, that we are ready.
Opponents of a proposal to cull thousands of badgers in Britain say it's only being done to ensure farmers spend less time and money doing their job. The cull, due to be approved later, is being carried out to help stop the spread of tuberculosis in cattle. Badgers will be shot by trained marksmen as part of the plan to remove the need for the mass slaughter of herds. Farmers say the cull is necessary because the wild animals can spread the disease to livestock, costing the industry and taxpayers millions of pounds a year. But Peter Smith, head of the Wildwood Trust, says it's rubbish science.
It's done to appease a very powerful lobby group, and it's all about money. It's all about farmers wanting to offset the costs of intensive cattle farming, and that's what causes TB. So if you want to stop TB, stop killing badgers and just put quarantine legislation in and stop subsidising farmers who are doing really bad things to their cows.
The microblogging website Twitter has agreed to a German government request to block access to a neo-Nazi account. Its tweets will no longer be visible to users in Germany, although the rest of the world will be able to view them. It's the first time the social networking site has implemented its local censorship policy, which came into force in January. The policy allows it to block content in specific countries if tweets violate local laws. Directors, neighbours and cinema-goers are mourning the death of the Dutch actress Sylvia Christel, known to millions around the world for her portrayal of Emmanuel. The iconic film, released in 1974, in which she starred, sealed the arrival of the sexual revolution in France. The former beauty queen died of cancer at the age of 60 in the Netherlands. She'd had the disease since 2000. She starred in several films, but won greatest prominence with Emmanuel, one of the first erotic films to be shown in mainstream cinemas in France. That's the latest Monocle 24 news.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. The time is just nudging 7 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong, Zurich,
London.
Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monocle, 24.
From London.
In London.
London, cara.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to the Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Now, it's one of the world's poorest countries. Many of its citizens exist on less than a dollar a day. It has one of the world's worst infant mortality rates as well. Angola is also one of Africa's biggest oil producers. And as a result, it is sitting on considerable wealth. So much, in fact, that it's just set aside $5 billion to go into a sovereign wealth fund. The country's president says it's to go into improving the country. But why now? Well, to find out more, I'm joined by the journalist Colin McClellan from Bloomberg. He's on a phone line from the Angolan capital, Luanda. Welcome to Midori House, Colin. Just explain briefly how this sovereign wealth fund came about and what it's supposed to do.
It's been around for a few years. I mean, the idea has... the IMF had a loan program here a few years ago. After the oil prices tanked in 2008, the country's finances were pretty hurt because about 97% of exports and 60% of the government revenue comes from oil. So the IMF, as part of this loan program, urged the country to set up a sovereign wealth fund so that it would stabilize the effect of external shocks like commodity price falls. So the idea has been around. The president set up a notion of a petroleum fund a couple of years ago, and it turns out that this petroleum fund is the sovereign wealth fund that was announced yesterday. So it's finally sort of come into fruition.
And where will this money be invested?
They have several ideas. Some, of course, in infrastructure being a large part of it, I guess. Transportation, hotels seem to be a big part of it, too. There's an idea for a hotel school in Luanda, where I am, the capital. So those are some of the ideas. I think what remains unclear at the moment is exactly the strategy for the fund. It's not quite clear whether this is a sort of an oil stabilization fund, whether it's a long-term sock away the money fund like in Norway, or whether it's an infrastructure investment fund, or how much of the money will be invested in these projects. Is it just going to be the return on investment that's going to be invested. It's wait and see right now.
You mentioned the possible destinations of any returns on this fund, such as hotels, for example. President Dos Santos has said that the money will go into Angola's infrastructure and also into social improvement. But how much do we genuinely believe him?
Well, I guess that's a matter of opinion. I think, I try to stay away from, opinion. What I see is the country opening up more. There's a big push on this announcement for transparency. The country has been near the bottom of the corruption index. So I see a bit of an opening up here. We can only hope it's true.
You mentioned the issues of transparency. The fund will, it has been said, will be accountable to the government. However, the fund will be managed by the president's son. How close an involvement in investment does the presidential family have in Angola's affairs?
I'm not really quite sure about all the intricacies of it. It's a pretty opaque system between the presidency and how funds are run. I don't know if it was a surprise to see the president's son move from what was the petroleum fund that had been announced a couple of years ago by his father and into this fund. Whether that, speaks for good transparency remains to be seen. It's hard to penetrate how the finances are run.
Let's look at the other great oil producer, Nigeria. That has a sovereign wealth law which ensures transparency. How much influence do you think that might be on Angola's operation?
I'm sure they look to that as a model. They look to other countries for models. I was told that Norway was a big inspiration, and I would assume that things are pretty transparent in Norway. Nigeria has just set up its fund. It's getting underway too.
Colin McLennan from Bloomberg, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line from Angola. That was Colin McLennan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time is 12 minutes past the hour. My next guest has just put together a magazine in a language nobody in her office speaks. The latest edition of The New Statesman is guest edited by the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei, a man upon whom the global spotlight has been trained ever since his arrest and detention last year by the Chinese authorities. The result of Ai's work is an edition dedicated to China, with the artist's clear, critical voice coming through every single page. Well, Sophie Elmhurst is a features editor at The New Statesman. She's the woman who persuaded Ai to come on board with The New Statesman. I'm delighted to say she joins us in the studio here at Midori House. Sophie, before we get into what's inside the magazine, just briefly explain the process by which you managed to persuade Ai to come on board.
Yeah, it took a while. We first approached him not that long after he'd come out of detention, as you say, last year. And I think we heard back about 6 months later. And the delay was understandable. He had a lot on. He always has a lot on. And he is still in a very precarious situation. But I think that his decision to do it is in a way that he decides to do lots of things. Once he thought about it and decided he wanted to do it, he was going to go all out, and he put in a huge amount of energy and sort of commitment to the whole process.
How did you go about compiling a magazine in a country that many of your staff members had never been to, that many of the people who lived in China were unable to get their information out? I mean, it sounds like a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, I think we realised it was going to be unlike anything we'd done before quite quickly. I certainly realised that when the first meeting we had was at 4 o'clock in the morning, UK time, over Skype. And I think as a result of that, we quickly realised it was only going to happen if one of us got on a plane, and it was me, luckily, in the end, and went to Beijing and sort of did it face to face. And from then, the process was intense. I'd say the vast majority of the magazine was written originally in Chinese. The whole theme of it is China. And I wanted it to be written, photographed, authored entirely by his population, his people. And so it was a question of getting all of that in, getting it translated, getting it edited, getting it rechecked in China here. It was a sort of long and complicated process, but worth it.
And faced with this astonishing opportunity to suddenly paint a portrait of a country that many people don't get to see in such great detail, in such depth, how did you select the subjects that ended up on the pages?
Absolutely. It was really his call. I mean, he was very clear from the off, from the moment he said yes, that this was going to be an issue dedicated to China. And I suppose, in his words, in a way, the dark side of China, the sides of China that the authorities perhaps don't want you to see or to know about. He is very well networked with fellow activists, fellow dissidents. There are a lot of lawyers writing, activists from Tibet, from rural communities, Chen Guangcheng, who's a very well-known, internationally known now dissident, now living in New York, who was able to escape the country, who has campaigned for a long time on the one-child policy in China. And it was really a gathering of these sorts of voices that I wanted to bring together.
It is a magazine which addresses the big subjects which are usually treated by the international media. You mentioned Chen Guangcheng, Tibet, and then there's this suffocating account of life by a human rights lawyer who finds himself trailed the entire time and arrested for no reason whatsoever. Mm. When you were talking to the people who were contributing to the magazine, to what degree were they aware that they might indeed be putting themselves at risk by writing?
I think in China, and all these people are sort of hardened activists in a way. They've been doing this for years, and many of them have been detained and have suffered the consequences of being outspoken. That as soon as they were invited by Ai Weiwei, they knew even the association with someone like Ai Weiwei. He is so renowned, even though he's so silenced in China. You know, you can't Google his name. Nothing comes up. He is censored out of the media in China. But anyone who agrees to do something for him knows what they're getting involved with, and I think leaps at the opportunity. They know that he, in a way, has come to symbolise something so much bigger than himself. He is a passport to international understanding and recognition for these issues, human rights issues in China.
You also, in addition to this very, very strong voice that you get of Ai Weiwei coming through, I mean, he does a lot of the interviews as well, you get a very strong portrait of China. You see its progress, this amazing picture halfway through of an electricity cable man installing something, goodness knows how high up. It's a brilliant picture. And there are also some incredibly strong and sexy portraits of women. Mm. When you were choosing the positive aspects of China, how did you go about selecting what you'd include there?
Well, again, I think it was very much from his steer in the sense that he wanted to show that there was this real creative energy in China, that there are people, especially of a younger generation, who as artists, as writers, are managing to find their own voices and express those voices and are doing that on an international stage. I mean, he's also sceptical about a lot of the art that's coming out of China at the moment and a lot of the film in the sense that there is so much self-censorship that goes on in the Chinese media and in the Chinese arts. And you have to sort of sweep that aside to get to the truth. But I think he does manage to bring together. I mean, I love particularly the rock lyrics right at the back of the magazine. There's two sort of dissident musicians and we printed the lyrics of their songs. And there are people who are sort of fighting the good fight, I suppose.
It leads me to ask you, what is your favourite bit of the magazine?
That's almost an impossible question.
Or the bit that gave you the most satisfaction putting together?
I think one of the things which felt really exciting was, well, two things. One was we asked, and he asked his Twitter followers, of which there are 170,000 of them, to contribute to the magazine. And we've done a spread in the magazine. We asked all his Twitter followers how they saw the future of China and got thousands and thousands of tweets in response, including a series of kind of crazy cartoons, which we've printed in the magazine as well. And I think getting those voices, you know, these really are voices, not even of the well-known activists and artists. These are voices of just very, very normal people in China who would never normally see themselves printed in a British magazine. And I think that was incredibly exciting to be able to print those voices. And I think also the fact that we have co-produced the magazine in Chinese, which is something that in our near 100-year history at the New Statesman we've never done before. So that's pretty cool.
You mentioned the people who are seeing their voices or seeing their words in print. How many of them do you think will ever see this edition of the New Statesman?
Well, it's unlikely they're going to see this printed in English form, but what we've done is to co-produce the magazine in digital form, PDF form, in the Chinese language. And what we're in the process of doing literally today and from now on is uploading that into file sharing sites. We've in a way pirated our own magazine in the hope that we can kind of skirt the Great Firewall and spread it and distribute it around China as much as we possibly can. So as much as anyone can help us do that, we'd be grateful.
Sophie, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Sophie Elmhurst, the features editor at The New Statesman, the woman who persuaded Ai Weiwei to guest edit her magazine. Stay with us here on Midori House. In a moment, we'll be looking at the Art Review's annual survey of the most influential players in the art world.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we head to Istanbul's inaugural Design Biennial. We poke around Lisbon's first open house weekend. And we go shopping with Shanghai gallerist Pearl Lam at the Pavilion of Art and Design in London.
Industrial design has been really important when we look at the Bauhaus, starting from Bauhaus time, because each of the design, each of the technology represent a certain time in history, reflecting economic, political and social.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
The time is 21 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Now, the world of contemporary art is used to controversy and intrigue, but few events set insiders' tongues a wagging quite as much as Art Review's annual survey of the most influential players in the art world. The Power 100 has divided opinion and sparked debate throughout the last decade, and the 11th edition revealed today is no exception. For the first time, a woman tops the list, with the curator Caroline Christov-Bakargiev at number one. So why was Caroline elevated, and what other controversies appeared along the way? Well, to find out, Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards spoke to the art editor of Art Review, Mark Rapolt, to find out more. Tom started by asking Mark why the announcement was made in Paris rather than at the magazine's home in London.
Not so much that in terms of art fairs, but basically over the last 5 years or so, the list has become more and more international, and therefore it didn't make sense to always launch it in London, which is the hometown for the magazine as well. And so it wasn't so much us picking one fair over another fair, but rather that it was a good opportunity to launch it in Europe rather than in the UK, in mainland Europe.
And, I mean, that international theme is something that's really strongly visible throughout the list. I mean, not just the number of people who feature from Asia or Latin America, but even we're seeing a real shift in power, perhaps, looking at the likes of Sheikha Al-Masiyah bint Hamad bin Khalita Al-Thani moving, soaring up the list. I mean, that's really interesting, isn't it? Does that tell us a great deal about how the art world is even more international than we thought it was?
I mean, I think it maybe says that the art world is not based around two or three specific centres in America and Western Europe, and that it's much more decentred than it used to be. But that could also be, you could say that's reflected globally in terms of economics anyway, and then maybe it's much more a case of art sort of matching real life.
That's very interesting, and I know that one thing a lot of people have observed about the lady who's at number one, we'll discuss the fact that she is a woman in a second, but that she's, you know, a curator of an event at Kassel in Germany, the Documenta 13, that's really, do you feel that's more of a sort of victory for, I guess, the social interactivity of art rather than, say, the traditional moneyed powerhouses? Is that what you were trying to convey with that finding?
I mean, I think partly. I mean, that I think there's a very optimistic outcome to reward something that demonstrated that art could interact with the real world and the real world, real society around us, rather than, as is, I guess, commonly thought, that art is basically the plaything for the rich and powerful. So I think it's a positive thing. I don't think we actively decided just because of that, but it was a very successful exhibition. And I think it's opened up some new and optimistic possibilities for art over the coming years.
And I wonder how difficult is it to balance the various conflicting, in some cases, influences that are operating when you compile a list like this, or your team of experts does? Because is there a need in some respects to seek controversial placings on the list? Do you think that that's a requirement in order to garner the interest and to, you know, make an impression in the sort of public domain? Or do you try and stick very much to a sort of principled position about things?
I think we try to stick to a principled position, which is why some years the same person stays at number one. It's why, for instance, on this list, sort of one of the more exotic inclusions, which is Pussy Riot, who I guess you could argue whether or not they're artists, aren't at the top, you know, because it would be much more sensational to put them right up there. And I think it's very much trying to reflect on the actual forces that are actually shaping the kind of art that's being produced and the kind of art that's being seen at the current time.
And so I would like to ask you now about the number one on the Art Review's Power 100. And just how significant is that, do you think, that we see a woman at the top of this list? I mean, obviously, it's an industry that has traditionally not been, you know, uniquely the stomping ground of, you know, the sort of big dogs at the top and men dominating the frame. Yeah. But is this a real breakthrough moment, do you think?
I mean, I think it's very difficult for me to say that, not being a woman. But at the same time, obviously, it is significant that this is the 11th year of the list and it's the first time a woman's been at the top. And I think, yes, of course, that is hopefully grounds for optimism in terms of sort of gender inequality, which definitely still does exist to some degree in the art world. But what its real effect is, I don't think I could really say.
So do you think that the real enduring influence then, the real opinion formers, will remain, I guess, what we would consider the traditional players, the big gallerists? I mean, it's interesting you've got the likes of Gagosian and Wirth and Zwerner and Jay Jopling still, you know, dominating the upper echelons. Are they still really the people who really matter ultimately?
No, I think in the end it's the artists that really matter. I think these are some of the ways in which the art gets transported into the world, and I think that's what the list is about, that these things don't happen by accident or just because someone is the very best, but there are other forces at work. So I think, yes, they're obviously incredibly important within the ecosystem of art, but I think in the end it's the art and the artists that are by far and away the most important thing.
Just finally, I wanted to ask you about some of the, I mean, you touched upon Pussy Riot's inclusion, but obviously we have the likes of Ai Weiwei still prominent in the list. Do you think that it's a good reminder, his ongoing influence and how much he still dominates and resonates in the art world and actually beyond, of exactly what the power of art can be on at its most fundamental level?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think you can look at, as we were talking earlier about money, you know, art is something that can make you a fortune or land you in jail. And I think the list is important for still highlighting these differences region to region. I think also with the case of someone like Ai Weiwei, it's very much this message that art can be an active force in society and can have something to contribute in the world, as opposed to sort of gathering dust in a museum wall or being the preserver of a rich elite. So I think it's very, very important.
And that was the editor of Art Review, Mark Rapolt, talking to Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards, a little earlier today. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. The news is coming up in just a few minutes. Taking us there, this is Gautier and Somebody I Used to Know. So happy you could die. I told myself that you were right for me, but felt so lonely in your company. But that was love and it's an ache I still remember. So when we found that we could not make sense, well, you said that we were.
would still be friends, but I'll admit that I was glad it was over.
And that was Gautier there on Monocle 24 and Somebody I Used to Know. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us because in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be heading into the wild of sorts as we talk to the Wildlife Photographer of the Year. And I'll also be joined in the studio by our senior editor, Sophie Grove. She'll be exploring the latest edition of Monocle magazine, which is devoted to health. And she'll also be talking about her favourite moments from Monocle 24. This, of course, includes the famous, well, within these walls, interview between our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield and the Finnish right-winger Timo Soini.
One of your MPs said that all gays and all Somalis should be exiled to an island. That doesn't sound like the sort of party you're describing.
Yeah. Have you anything which is serious to ask from me?
That is a treat well worth sticking around for. But with the time at 33 minutes past the hour, before all that, let's get the latest world news headlines from Bill.
Differences are emerging between European leaders in Brussels on the eve of their two-day summit, the 22nd since the EU first began to face up to its debt crisis. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has called for the European Commission to be given greater authority to veto national budgets that breach EU rules. But French President François Hollande said such discussions are not on the agenda. Much of Greece has been closed down by a 24-hour general strike. Public and private sector workers have joined the walkout, shutting down transport, offices, shops and schools. The Colombian government and left-wing FARC rebels have arranged their first direct talks for a decade. After almost 50 years of conflict, the two sides launched the peace process at a hotel in Norway, with negotiations expected to last several months. Human rights groups in Syria say nearly 30,000 people are missing after being abducted by the army or pro-government militia. The online activist group Avaaz says the government is conducting a campaign of terror from which nobody is safe. Opponents of a proposal to cull thousands of badgers in Britain say it's only being done to ensure farmers spend less time and money doing their job. The cull is going to be carried out to help stop the spread of tuberculosis in cattle. Badgers will be shot by trained marksmen as part of a plan to remove the need for the mass slaughter of herds. The microblogging website Twitter has agreed to a German government request to block access to a neo-Nazi account. Its tweets will no longer be visible to users in Germany, although the rest of the world will be able to view them. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news at the bottom of the hour.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. Bill will be back in a little under half an hour with a full roundup of the world news. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Midori House in London. Wildlife photography has arguably a quality all of its own. The finest, most breathtaking pictures of the natural world are often the result of days, weeks even, of waiting and striving for the perfect shot. And the story behind the winner of this year's Wildlife Photographer of the Year is no exception. Paul Nicklin, whose chaotic image of emperor penguins claimed first prize, took the shot while he was trapped under ice at the edge of the Ross Sea in Antarctica. His picture triumphed over more than 48,000 other entries. And the resulting exhibition of Paul's picture and of those who made the final cut showcases the finest in the wildlife genre. Monocle's David Pleasant has been to find out.
I'm Ros Kidman-Cox and I'm one of the judges, and I've been a judge for quite a few years now in the competition.
And could you tell us a little bit about the judging process? What are the criteria? What is it you're looking for within all the different categories?
I'd say the first thing we look for is artistic merit. And I think you'll agree when you see some of the winning pictures, you know, they are not just nature pictures. They are beautiful, beautiful pictures, and they should be regarded as art. But because the subject matter is what it is, there are other criteria. Obviously, the picture needs to, I think, be a fresh picture. Unfortunately, although fortunately for the good photographers, I think amateurs tend to copy what they see and think that, you know, well, if they're going to win a competition, they must have a bear catching a salmon, or they must have some rare animal. And the young people in this competition, I think, show you that you can take beautiful pictures of wildlife that's close to home. And we also do ask for raw files, and those are the original files, so we can check if there's any digital manipulation outside the rules. Some photographers complain that perhaps what they consider their best photographs went out in the early rounds, and of course it takes several weeks to actually get through, you know, 48,000 pictures. And, you know, you have to be careful that you know, sometimes a photographer deliberately has a blurred image. You know, if you can, you have to kind of think about it in an artistic way, just a bit beyond the technical expertise. But obviously, if the focus is on a portrait and that, you know, portrait is sharp on the beak and just slightly soft on the eyes, it's not going to work as powerfully as it could if it was sharp on the eyes and soft on the beak, for example. So yes, you are, I suppose, with any competition, what you're doing is looking for reasons to exclude pictures. And that's sad, but you have to.
I'm Luciano Canzani from Brazil. I'm a photojournalist, nature photojournalist for 17 years now. And this image here is a caiman underwater in the Pantanal wetlands of Brazil.
And a caiman is a type of crocodile, is that correct?
Yes, it's a crocodilian. It's a kind of crocodilian, very common in Brazil. This picture forms part of a bigger story for National Geographic that wants to show how important the water dynamics in the Pantanal wetlands of Brazil is for a species like this caiman here.
And the image, maybe you could describe it to us. What are we looking at? It's quite kind of almost, I don't know, there's something scary but also slightly comic or friendly about it. Yeah. I can't quite describe. Tell us a bit about the image.
Okay. This image here, it shows a caiman underwater, and it's actually heavily sedimented yellowish waters, and this mouth match perfectly my emotional response in front of this predator. And I think it's actually an image of the wetlands that's ingrained in my imagination since my father showed me a caiman for the first time some 25 years ago.
So it's the classic crocodile image. There's a gaping jaw with his teeth out, kind of coming right at the camera, and in the background there's some fish. How did you put yourself in that position without getting your you know, head chopped off?
To work very close to the animal. And I slowly getting closer and closer, and studying the reactions of this animal. This species is not that aggressive, but it's important to, you know, to pay attention. It's a predator. I hope my images can inspire people to take care of the planet. This image is special because there are many threats around, like big dams that can change the water dynamics in this area. So this project is to show how important the water is.
My name is Paul Nicklin, and I'm here in London today to attend the awards of the Veolia BBC Wildlife Photographer of the Year contest, and I'm very fortunate to have won four images of one in this contest, and one image won the grand prize.
And what is that image?
It's a very chaotic image of emperor penguins underwater surfacing, rocketing to the surface in the Ross Sea of Antarctica as they come up to breathe and get ready to exit the water.
Can you tell us a little bit about the composition and what resulted, the picture that you ended up with, and what kind of process went into that?
It was a very tough situation to shoot because it's so chaotic. When you have 300 emperor penguins coming in from the open sea into a hole that's only 3 or 4 meters in diameter, and I have to be in the water with my legs locked underneath the ice, so I'm not moving. I don't want to seem like a predator to them. I need to get them to relax around me. And not only do they relax so well that the shot that I like, the one that won, is a large emperor penguin is resting against my head, and his body is framed in my fisheye lens and the dome of my camera, so he frames that part of the frame. And as he's resting there, I think the other penguins took relaxation. They got relaxed seeing him there resting against me. I'm definitely not a predator at this point. And they all just started to casually swim up. So I was trying to find that moment, that pattern, when all the penguins came together, framed by the penguin in the upper frame of the corner. And you know, it's happening so fast. You're cold and you're worried about leopard seals. And, you know, I'm shooting 10 frames a second just as they're coming up, like, as they're coming up, because it's that fast when they come up to the surface. So there was one moment where the chaos sort of, it's still chaotic, it's not a perfect picture, but I'm not about perfect photography. I'm about capturing nature the way it is. It's beautiful enough, you know, you don't need to force it. And that's why I was excited to have that picture win.
You were fearing some years ago that perhaps it was all going to video in terms of wildlife photography. Can you explain a little bit about why stills have such appeal in terms of wildlife? What's the attraction?
As we sort of went from the magazine newspaper era, everything seemed to be going to TV and the iPad. I was sure we were going to lose all the young up-and-cover photographers to video. And in fact, for me, I think the opposite's happened. There's nothing more powerful and arresting than a single image that says it all. One image can tell an entire story, and that one image will create a mood. I don't find with video and motion that I get this incredibly moody, surreal scene that you can lose yourself in. And in a powerful image, you can go look at an amazing image 50 different times and learn something each time. And you can't get that with a video that's running at 24 frames a second across your TV and it's gone. And what I love is to take a set of those images collectively, say 12 to 15 pictures that go into, say, National Geographic, and now it's my chance with those 10 images or whatever it is to reach out to 40 million readers of National Geographic and really tell my story. And an amazing image has to be both informative and has to tell a story, has to be journalistic, but it also has to be beautiful. And as a journalist, it's my job to take a reader who's bored, you know, whether they're sitting there with Hello Magazine or whether they're sitting there with National Geographic as they're bored in a doctor's office, it's my job to lure that reader into my story. That's my obligation as a journalist.
And that was Monocle's David Pleasant reporting there. And the exhibition of the Wildlife Photographer of the Year begins tomorrow at London's Natural History Museum and lasts until March next year. You're listening to Midori House. After this break, Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, will give us a behind-the-scenes look at the latest issue of Monocle magazine. Stay with us.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new programme on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of the print media. It
exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals and newspapers, and talking to people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Running on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show is an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
Wherever you're going this autumn, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Barts, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just go to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And the time is 15 minutes before the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Issue 58 of Monocle hits the newsstands this week. I have one in my paws. And joining me in the studio to talk about the business and affairs section of the magazine is the magazine's senior editor, Sophie Grove. Hello, Sophie. Lovely Hello. To have you back in the studio. You're no stranger to this place now. We'll come to Monocle 24 in just a moment. We will move to the business and affairs section of the magazine, but there is a new direction that Monocle is arguably taking with this.
Well, we haven't done a health issue before specifically. We do the yearly index of the most livable cities, which is much more about sort of holistic quality of life. And this is more specifically looking at the medical innovations, but also sort of quite interestingly sort of longevity, what makes people healthy in the broader sense of the world. We're looking at exercise and some of the more kind of quirky areas of the healthcare sector. And it's fascinating. It's a vast, vast subject. So we looked, we worked with the OECD getting some sort of data across the board, looking internationally about, you know, quite fascinating stats like, you know, the country with the most doctors, Greece. You know, the country with the lowest obesity rate, Japan, 3.5%.
Which is possibly slightly less surprising than Greece.
Exactly. But it's so... Steve Bloomfield and I were sort of crunching through some of these metrics, trying to sort of find the Monocle take on all of this, because, you know, often, you know, mortality rates hide a lot of what really matters in health, which is, you know, management, but also... sort of other things to do with, you know, actually just healthcare and just the quality of the hospital, the happiness of the nurses. And so that's what we were looking at. It was great fun, actually.
It is a very interesting read, because it explores the sort of the on-the-ground providers of medicine as well. Let's just turn briefly, though, to the business section and a sort of fusion of health, well, health in a tiny little bottle. One of these lovely stories about this... the sort of domination of the Japanese market of these tiny little drinks that, you know, one's been around for 60 years, but they seem to be the current craze, their entire renewability. Just very briefly tell us about it.
So it's a fascinating and very lucrative industry in Japan. It's worth over 1.2 billion euro a year. Well, that was last year. Expected to be even more next year. And it's just this incredible niche for these 100ml drinks that are range from everything from sort of like glorified energy drinks to drinks that have sort of liquidized viper tail in them. And they...
Well, you don't have some of that in your fridge already.
Exactly. They're so beautifully marketed and, you know, some of them are aimed specifically at women, very pink, very sort of niche little bottles. You can buy them in pharmacies sort of refrigerated. I think that they started by sort of, you know, these energy pills, but, you know, recently and not so recently, some of them have been around, as you say, for decades, they've been chilled. And, you know, the Japanese really rely on them. And they're marketed as things like, you know, for exhausted workers to pep you up in the morning.
I particularly like the one that's called Mega Shaky.
But Fiona Wilson did such a great job reporting it. We shot all the bottles. They're beautiful, just really visually quite interesting. And it's a market like no other. So it's an insight into the healthcare sector there.
Issue 58 of Monocle's hitting the stands this week. In a moment, though, Sophie, stay with us because I want to talk to you about our year-long anniversary of Monocle 24. We asked you to choose a song that you particularly liked from the past year. What was it?
Anna Bloom. It was wonderful. She's a Norwegian, incredible guitarist and singer, and she came in quite early on, actually, and just captivated every single one of us, really.
Let's have a listen.
We went back to bed when we found our first position and every muscle rested. I don't remember that I already knew it was the last time. The last time for first positions. The last time you're being mine. Do you remember the scars I showed you, the stories I told you, how I always said forever when you asked me to stay true? Do you remember how we forgot how to smile at each other, to believe that the other wants only what's good for you?
And that was Anna Brunner, a live version of her song, Do You Remember? It's one of the choices of Sophie Grove, our senior editor, who's joined me in the studio today on Midori House to recap on her finest moments. Well, not necessarily her finest moments. There were too many of those to count in the next 5 minutes. But to pick her favourite bits of Monocle's nigh on 8,000 hours of broadcasting that have gone through these walls in the last year. You wanted to talk to us about a couple of your favourite moments. What was your first one?
Well, the first one is a great moment from my colleague, Steve Bloomfield, in his most hectoring tone and form, speaking to the True Finns leader, Timo Soini, who is a very right-wing contender, or was a contender for the Finnish election earlier in January. Steve just took... really kind of went in a combative mood, and this is the man I have to work with.
To many outsiders, you know, Finland has a global reputation as an open, friendly, modern, progressive society. It's not the sort of place where we imagine a far-right party like your own would be successful.
This was wrong altogether. The start was false. Our party is not far-right. Where can you put that kind of impression?
I mean, this is what many of your opponents and many other people in Finland, this is how they describe you. I mean,
now you are questioning me, and I don't accept those kind of labels.
Okay, so how would you describe yourself and your party?
We are a party for Finnish independence, for Finnish self-governance and direct democracy, lots of referendums, that sort of stuff.
There are people within your party, including some MPs, who have very strong anti-immigrant views, who have very strong anti-gay views. One of your MPs, Toivo Haikarainen, said that all gays and all Somalis should be exiled to an island. That doesn't sound like the sort of party you're describing.
Yeah. Have you anything which is serious to ask from me?
Sorry, is that not a serious question? One of your own MPs said all gay people and all Somalis should be exiled to an island. I'm just asking whether that fits in with...
I thought that you were interviewing Timo Soini.
Yes, but you're the leader of the party, yeah. Correct?
I am.
I'm just asking
so
about...
Why don't you ask something from me?
And that was our foreign news editor, foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, taking a rather robust approach towards the Finnish right winger Timo Soini. It's a choice of Sophie Grove, our senior editor of one of Monocle 24's best bits from the last year. What else was on your list?
So there was a great moment, this was actually last year, in December, when we decided to tackle the issue of art and science. We spoke to CERN about their resident artist, and I interviewed them, which was great. And then we spoke to a quantum physicist by the name of Dr. Dave Glowacki, brilliant name, and he's invented, apparently, so he could explain to his friends and his girlfriend exactly what he did in the quantum physics department, a dance sort of interactive, immersive video game slash kind of installation, really.
Sounds simple enough. Let's have a listen.
What we do is we simulate a bunch of atoms based on the laws of quantum mechanics, and we project it into the room in an art museum. Either we've done it in domes, we can do it on flat screens, we can do it any sort of thing. So we simulate all these particles, so you actually see the particles, and what happens is you see the particles in the room. They're bouncing around, interacting with each other. And in the absence of anybody being in the room, the only thing the particles feel is they feel every single other particle. So the energy field, if you like, that any particle feels just depends on where all the other particles are at any point in time. But what happens when somebody steps in the room is they are actually an external energy field that the particles immediately in real time respond to and self-assemble around. So the minute you step into the room, you induce an instantaneous field, a virtual field in the room, and you see the effects of it on the projections. And simultaneous to that, we use a bunch of tricks from laser spectroscopy, and we convert the chaos of the particle system into soundscapes. So as people, either individually or in big groups, the project's actually more interesting when big groups of people are cooperating and do things. They simultaneously shape the visuals and mold the soundscape, all in real time, based on real physics.
Dave Glowacki there, the quantum physicist. Sophie Grove, I'm just as baffled as I was a minute and a half ago.
The brilliant thing about it was I went along to the installation after I'd spoken to him, and it was brilliant. It was like being in this kind of wonderful atomic world, and you sort of actually, for a very split second, thought you might understand something like string theory. And I think it's just, I love the way we've done this. We've gone from, you know, crazy physicists to hard politics. This is sort of breadth of what we've been covering over the last year, and that's what I quite love.
Not to mention a little bit of beat jazz too.
No, this next moment was probably my favourite. It was a Thursday night. Rob Bowne was presenting, and we just decided we're going to do a piece on the road, because the squirrel was in town that Jack Kerouac wrote the piece on, and we called up one of his jazzer friends and just spoke about near life as a beat.
Let's listen to it.
Poet.
One night when I was copying a piece of music, Jack said, "Come on over, man." I said, "Well, I can't. I have to finish the copying." He said, "Well, I'll tell you some stories while you're copying." For 7 hours, he told me the most incredible story of going to Morocco and then visiting a group of French soldiers, and how the Algerian soldiers would come into the barracks of people that were supposed to be their enemy and hang out all night talking as young guys. Finally, I saw that the sun was coming up and I'd finished copying this piece of music. I said, "Jack, if I'd only had a tape recorder, that could have been a novel." And he said, "That's what I try to do, Davey. I try to make the listener feel that I'm talking to them. And in this case, the listener is also the reader. So I try to have the person who's reading that book feel that I'm speaking to him." And then he said, "I can never quite get it." So he was striving for that naturalness to make the formal feel spontaneous.
A voice that almost personifies the Beat Generation, I'd argue, Sophie Grove. That was Howard Cunnell, and a great choice.
He was wonderful.
He was great. Thank you very much indeed for coming down and sharing your best bits of the last year here on Monocle 24. That's all we have time for today's edition of Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, our researcher, Andy Sidgley. Our studio manager was Sam Impey. Up next, after the news, is this week's episode of The Urbanist. Today, they'll be meeting the man whose job is to rebuild bits of Berlin that still lie in pieces over 6 decades after the Second World War. Don't forget, in 3 hours' time, that's at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Ted Kravitz will be back for the Monocle Daily, and Hugo McDonald will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening.